After Mother was operated on and they sewed her up, they brought her home. They tried to keep her doped where she couldn't live. And people of the family took turns staying with her. Dorothy, Ariel and Dorothy lived in Logan, out west of Logan that year. And Dorothy came in there one day to stay with her, and somebody had to stay with her, at least in the daytime. And she rallied this. I made a mistake. I called Aunt Alby. It was Aunt Alby, the bee. Aunt Alby, Aunt Esther, and Aunt Em. Now I'll continue with that story. After Mother was operated on and they sewed her up, they brought her home. They tried to keep her doped where she couldn't live. And people of the family took turns staying with her. Dorothy, Ariel and Dorothy lived in Logan, out west of Logan that year. And Dorothy came in there one day to stay with her, and somebody had to stay with her, at least in the daytime. And she rallied. They had given her enough morphine to put her out. They thought she'd die any day, any day, any day. We'd wired Reed if the operation was a failure, her mother would die any day. And she rallied and said, "Dorothy, when Merle Heyer comes to get me, you let him in. And you be sure and let him in." And she insisted. And Dorothy said, "Yes, we'll do that, we'll do that, we'll do that." And she didn't really know. And she didn't know but what Mother was just delirious, and I think maybe she was. But anyway, she rallied and just raised all kind of fuss. She was coming home. She wanted to come home. So we brought her home. We got an ambulance and brought her home. And this was in February. And that winter, it was 30 below every stinking night. There was some nights went to 40 below. Sugar factory registered one night there, about the first part of February, of 37 below. Snow clear up over the fence post. You could drive a team and bobs right out over the fence. Now, we were milking cows, and we had calves to feed, and cattle to feed outside. And hard now, we're just running wild, trying to keep up. And anyway, we brought Mother home. And I got home here. And she said, "You call Bishop Hendricks." That was Dave Hendricks. "And have him bring James Taggart with him. And give me a blessing. I've got to get out of this pain. I can't take any more. I've had all I can take." We couldn't give her enough morphine to put her out. She just screamed with pain. That cancer, that stomach, I guess it was the most painful thing. Anyway. So I called the bishop. When the bishop came in the door, he said, "Oh my land. She asked for James Taggart." And I went right out of the house and got in the car and went down and got Merle Heyer. And I said, "This is just fine. This is just fine." And Merle said, "Let's go get James Taggart." And I said, "No, it's cold, it's miserable. It's 30 below tonight. This is good enough." He came in. Bless her, she'd be eased of pain. From then on, she calmed down and quietly slept away. By midnight, she was gone. Well, we had wire Reed, telephone service, what they did. Said Mother died. I don't know what he felt like in the mission. I got a phone call the next day from Bishop Hendricks. I was the one that answered the phone. 17-year-old boy, remember this. I was a kid that was scared of the dark. I was scared to go any place in the dark. And here I was. I had to grow up real fast. Anyway. Reed never got told this story until just a few years ago. Bishop Hendricks called and said, "I have a call. I've got to return to President LeGrand Richards, who's president of the mission. Wondering if He should let Reed come home to his mother's funeral. Good cry, man. I said, Bishop, the trains are blocked. It'd take him 2 weeks to get here if he could get here, and I don't think he could get here because the Union Pacific coming across Wyoming can't run. It's snowbound. There's no way to get him here. You tell him it's a family decision. He stay there. We'll handle it here, and he can handle it there. And we'll write him a letter and tell him about the funeral. And so that's what the bishop, you know. Some years ago, Reed asked me, he said, you know, I've often wondered. But Grand Richard called back and said it was the family's decision to stay home. And I said, Reed, I was going to tell you about that, and I forgot it. I said I was the family. I couldn't figure out any way for you to get home. You was far better off to see Mother, as you remember Mother, as you saw her as you left on your mission. She had deteriorated. Mother was a good-sized woman. I don't know that excessively big, but she was a pretty good-sized gal. And she weighed less than 100 pounds when we buried her. She'd down to just skin and canter. And I said, to look at her would have haunted you, it'd have broke your heart. And you were better off out there. I know how hard it was. It wasn't any easier here. And I thought you were better off there. And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But then that's just the way it was. Then we went, we put Alan in line. The six boys carried Dad to his grave in November of 1935. The five boys and the one son-in-law, Alan Jorgensen, carried Mother to the grave in February of 1937. That was the toughest course I ever went through, I believe. Now, there have been things in my life since that I don't suppose I could have taken had I have not finally grown up out of this. But anyway, I was out of school for a week while we buried Mother. And I'll never forget one fine teacher I had in American history. I was a junior in high school. Mother E.B. Olson lived in Logan. And so he asked somebody the day of the mid-year exam in history, said, where's Lindsay? Somebody said he's burying his mother today. Oh, sorry to hear that. When I went back, I went to him and I said, Mr. Olson, could I make up the test that I missed? He looked at me and said, I thought you did just fine on that test. You did just fine. Did just fine. I thanked him. And a few years ago, I met him. He's an old man. And I thanked him again for that. People were real kind to us. I had made an agreement with my father many years prior to this. As he said to me, Lynn, I never did believe and sending a kid to church. But I can't take you. I took the others, but I can't take you. I just can't go. I just can't go. So I made an agreement with him that I would go without him. And I've always gone. I've lived up to that agreement. One time, as kids, they tried to get us to bear testimony in sacrament meeting, and I didn't want to do it. I wasn't very fluent in my speech. I didn't have control of it, and I didn't want to. Maybe a little bit rebellious, I don't know, but I didn't want to. So Dad talked to me, and he said, I would like you to do it. And I said, I don't want to. And he said, why? And I said, I'm not sure. He said, well, when you are sure, then will you bear it? And I said, yes. And he said, all right, I'll buy that. I'll buy that. Now, Dad was pretty sound, but in this agreement that I had with him, and I think it was the year he died, that I went back to him, and I said, I'd like to change our agreement. And he said, what's your trouble? I said, I would like to be excused from fast and testimony meeting. He said, well, why? And I said, well, there's three men there, and I'm not going to put their names on this tape, but I told him the three men that I said they take up most of the time, every time, seems like to me, at least that's the way it seemed to me. And they're always cussing the youth. And they gotta cuss me. There's two or three of us there, and that's all. This was a big ward. There isn't very many youth there. There's very many of us there. And they all take turns at us. Terrible kids are. And they accuse us of sins that I don't even know what they're talking about. Dad said, well, you know what you're doing? He said, you know the gospel's true. Adherence to its principles will save you in the celestial kingdom. And you know what you're doing? You're letting their actions drive you out of the church. And I wouldn't let anybody drive you out of the church. Don't let anybody drive you out of the kingdom. Drive you out of what is your birthright. You can have, you've got, if you just stay with it. Good land. He said, I wouldn't object if you want to sleep through their sermons, like be like a good high priest and sleep through their sermons. But I wouldn't let anybody drive you out of the church. Don't do that. So he talked me out of being excused from meeting. I thought that was good, wise counsel. I've passed that on many times. But all these were lonely years from there on. Keith Clayson tells that in years to come later, he and I chased around on courting and chased around a lot. And he said, Lynn, I'd stop and let you out of the house, out of the car to go to the house. And the house was probably going to be cold. There's no lights in the house many times, no lights. And I thought, my land, there he goes. There's nobody to check on him to see whether he's there. Said I couldn't understand it. And that's quite a way to grow up. But in the spring, that's the way I'd kind of got used to it. I'd kind of come a tie. I never let anybody see my weepings and wailings. I never done that in public. I did that alone. And sometimes I gave myself a pretty stirring speech to get myself out of the dumps. Yeah. I continued on to church. I got to tell this one on read. From the time my mother died, and I think that very next Mother's Day, they always had some youth give a talk to mothers. And it fell my lot. And they always had the 15th of June. June day, the day before, and a midnight dance. And I'd come home from that midnight dance, milk the cows, and have a bath, and get ready, go to church. And I remember when Gwendolyn Hogan was playing the organ back in the piano up behind. I believe it was, the organ, I think, right up behind me. She was the same dance I was. And I said, "Are you wide awake?" And she said, "No." I said, "You got to be to play that now. You keep me awake so I don't miss my turn at that pulpit." But from then on until after I'd filled a mission, maybe married, some kid, they always had me talk on Mother's Day. Now, I had a good mother. I had a good dad. And I hoped I've honored him in all my doings. Now, in 1938, Reed came home from mission, just ahead of Mother's Day. And I give a part on that program, as usual. And when I came down off that stand, which was usual, this one good lady, Sister Drury, I guess she couldn't figure out me living down here and no parents to get me to church, and I was still there. And I'd prepared one speech. Reed told me it was the wrong talk, so he prepared one for me. And I thought that was kind of him, but I got there and gave him on anyway. And I seen him just as I sat down, shook his fist, and I could just read his lips, and he said the kid gave the wrong talk. Anyway, as I came down off that stand at rostrum, here comes Sister Drury to weep on my shoulder about the fact that my mother was gone. And Reed got there just in time that I grabbed him. I was the biggest. And drug him over there, and she put her arms on him, around his neck, and wept on his shoulder and told him that speech. I'd heard that speech two different times, at least once. I'd heard that before. I didn't need to hear it again. And I come on home and was cooking dinner when he got here. He was almost too mad to eat his dinner. There's another humorous story right here. As Reed got home from his mission, and he reported his mission, Hard Reed and I was living here. We washed the dishes before we ate and stood after. And we'd come home from church. One was a washing dishes, one was a cooking dinner, another, and I was sweeping the floor. And I let out a war whoop as I saw coming up the path Laura Packer. I don't know what her married name is, and her husband. Her husband carrying their little girl. Now, this was the girl that Reed left behind when he went on a mission. And I said, "Reed, you go out and stall her till we get a little bit of law and order in this house before you let her in." Now, by golly, I just can't let her in yet. Now you go out there and do what you can do. Now you keep back as long as you can, then you can come in. And we get the doors open and we get the windows open, and we get a little bit more respectable, but not much. And Laura came in. She didn't know. She knew of Dad's dead. She didn't know of Mother's. And I used to tease Reed about this. Years later, when I was in the temple the day to get Glenn's endowments before he left on his mission, there was Laura. And she walked up and said, "Lynn, is this your son?" "Yes." I said, "Laura, this is my second boy. He's going to England on a mission. I have a boy in Canada now on a mission." then I went around and got a hold of her arm. And I said, and Glenn had a girl as he left to go on a mission. I didn't really know what he thought of the girl or what the girl thought of him. Anyway, I said, now Glenn, do you remember me telling you the story of three old bachelors living in a house? And one came home from a mission. And they'd just come from church, and one was sweeping the floor, and one was washing the dishes, and another one cooking the dinner. And here come Reed's old girlfriend with her husband and their little girl to see him. And that old Laura's black eyes just sparkled, and I thank goodness I had a hold of her arm. I thought an awful lot of her. She's a real fine gal. And she said, I could have killed him. And I said, who, Reed? And she said, no, not Reed. She said, that was my husband's idea, not mine. I wouldn't have come. And I said, oh, you've ruined my story. For 25 years, I've teased Reed that he wrote to you even though you were married. She said, he never wrote me one letter while he was on his mission. And I said, oh dear, now you've ruined my story. But I've met Laura a time or two, and I never forgot that. My golly. Well, let's stop. I'm going back to this part of the story where I asked Dad for permission not to go to church on fast day. Now, sometime after that, why? Dad told me, he asked me of the men's names. I don't believe I got that in there. And I'm not going to put the names on tape. But I gave him the three men's names. And he said, well, two of them I knew as boys. And all they're doing is they think you act like they did when they were boys. And I said, I didn't act like they did when they were boys, and I was a boy. We were boys same time. No, I didn't act like they did. I said, and the third man fits the bill. So don't worry about it. Whatever thou do, don't let them run you out of church. Well, some months later, I was working on thrashing crew with this man whom Dad didn't know. And this was a Monday morning right after a fast day when he had tuned this whole ward up, boy. He'd taken us all to task in his testimony, and he'd taken just about all the time, and he'd shook both fists, waved those arms. He'd been a good street meeting preacher. And I sit there and I looked at him and I looked at him, and I didn't go to sleep. He made too much noise. And so the next day we were on the bundle wagon. We were pitching together. He paired us off pitching bundles together. And there's one good thing about a thrashing crew, why sometimes a thrasher broke down, you gotta rest a minute or two. We'd caught up and the thrasher had stalled, and we sat down out in that old grain field, and it was hot. And I had been all day waiting for this opportunity. And if it come, what would I say? So we sat down there, and I called the man by name. And I said, you took a lot of time yesterday. And I said, here I am, planning to fill a mission, trying to figure out a way to finance it. I don't know any rule I've broken that would bar me from it. You accused us. I've got started here. I was having a little static in the gallery, Judy. That's not part of the story. But anyway, as I told this man, I'm trying to figure out how to go on a mission, how to finance it. I haven't broken any rule that would bar me from it. I haven't committed any of those sins that you accused us of yesterday, and it must have been me you was accusing me, because there wasn't very many of us there, kids. After I became a priest, I administered the sacrament every Sunday. Win, lose, or draw, because I was about the only one there. Out of all the rest of the priests, they'd get one there sometimes. But I was there. And I said, I don't understand your point of view to this man. The ones you were accusing of all these sins weren't there. Now why didn't you say something to uplift the ones that were there instead of downgrading us? And he sat there and he looked right down at the ground. And I waited for quite a while. I thought, well, guess if he wants to get up and clean up on me, why, he's big enough to do it. Finally, he lifted up his head and said, you know, I wish I could say that of my youth. Then I understood what Dad was trying to tell me. That immorality breeds distrust, disbelief. They get to where they don't trust anybody. And as I got on my own mission, I found that to be more the case. Where the prophet Joseph Smith was a preaching one time, and the man came up and asked him for a sign. He said, you're immoral. And somebody else said, that's right, he is. And so many times it's people see their own sins in other people. I guess that's so they feel better, but well, as the spring of 1939 rolled around, I said to Howard and Reed one day, I'd gone to college that year and hadn't done too good in school. I don't know. But anyway, I got down there and got overloaded. But there was a lot of things that I didn't have the home to come to. I had to make it where it went. And I thought I'd missed a part. Now these people that had their parents around all their lives, that they could go and have counsel with, I'd kind of envied. But anyway, kind of real early in the spring, 1939, I said, well, brethren, it's time for me to fill a mission. I'll go this fall. And Howard said, well, I want to fill a mission. It never dawned on me about Howard going on a mission. And I said, why haven't you gone? And he said, well, I should have went when Edis went. I said, why didn't you? He said, nobody ever asked me. Reed said, you mean the bishop has never asked you to go on a mission? No. And he said, tomorrow, you and I will go see the bishop. And one of us will ask him about you going on a mission. If you don't want to do it, I will. and could land hard was 30 years old, I believe. Should have gone 10 years before. The family could have financed him just as easy then as they did any other time. So I said, now, if you want to go, then you get out of here. He said, well, I thought I'd go this fall. And I said, no, you're not. You're going now. Because I've waited all my life to go on a mission. That means I'll have to wait 2 more years. And there's a few madmen tramping around over Europe wanting to fight. We could get into a war and all of us miss our missions. Now you get out of here. Came home that night and Reed said, well, we've got half his papers filled out today. So he headed right on his mission, I think, in May of 1939. Well, we went on and I got ready to go. Got enough money mowed and stacked up. I'd worked and bought me a couple of cows on mowing. I didn't want anybody, I wanted to do it myself pretty much. That's good. And bought these 2 cows, and they were good cows. Reed said, I'll milk them and send you the money. And those 2 cows would have done my mission. Both of them died just as I was getting ready to go. One just before I left, the other one just after I got out there. I'd have been ahead had I have taken the money. See, $25 a month would do me. And had I have taken, I had $250 and those 2 cows. That was a lot of money back those days. Well, if I'd had $250, had another 100 or Mel Gilbert owed me some money. I'd been working for him and kind of saving it up, and he was sending it to me by the month, which got me through. Now, Reed, I mean, Hard, and I were both on a mission from January, February, and March. Hard came home in April, I believe. His companion died in a mission field, and Hard brought him home. And, So us 3 missionaries trying to get ourselves on a mission, we almost went broke. Reed often said if we hadn't went on a mission, we would have went broke. And I believe maybe that's right. I never had the time, I never had the money, I never had the health. I grew up with a real bad health problem, and when I was 13 years old, they discovered I had gallstones. And that thing aggravated to the point I had ulcers before they got done with it. And I sympathize with Mark on his mission now. His health isn't very good. Neither was mine. I've often said I didn't have the health, I didn't have the money, I didn't have the time. But I thank the Lord that I went on a mission. I learned the gospel. I received a testimony that God lives, that Jesus is the Christ, and that's where I found it. It was on a mission. So, that seems like that's about all I'm going to tell today. Good night, Judy. Judy, as I proofread this back on that date I gave you of June the 15th, back on that. That's a mistake, so blot that out. That's wrong. Good night.
This matter of health, my first encounter with that was, I think, in 1927, when I, just as school got out. I just finished my first grade in school, and one bright day, Dr. Parkinson and some other doctor came down here and took Owen and I and took her tonsils out. Now, they laid me on the front room table, on the kitchen table, took out my tonsils. And Owen, when they put him on the table, I had to get the sewing machine up there to make him fit. He wasn't a very tall man, but he was a little taller than I was, a kid. But anyway, Uncle Gowdy Hogan and Dad held me down while they gave me ether. And I fought that ether with all my heart, with all I had. And they finally got enough down me to put me out. And I guess that fighting spirit was still there as I started to come to. Now, Dad never said anything to me about it, but Mother did. Mother said she finally had to leave. Because I was coming out of ether, I called them every dirty son of a gun that I could lay my tongue to. And she said, you know, those two men, your dad and your uncle, Uncle Gowdy, I guess, was in the state presidency, I think, at that time. And he'd look at Dad and he'd say, Alf, my land, that boy used good language. And Dad would say, yeah, and he used it proper, too. It just comes right out, just good, proper speech. Now, this always bothered me, especially in 1947, after I'd been married just not quite a year. Ray was a baby. In February, I was married. Julie and I were married in 2nd of April, 1946. And along at that time, well, here, before we get going on that one, I better tell you, when they took Owen's tonsils out, why, Owen never talked. 2 weeks, at least, maybe a month. I thought that was a pretty good deal. Mother'd give me a nickel every day, and I'd go up town and have me an ice cream cone. That's about the only thing that'd go down that sore throat. Every day I'd go have me an ice cream cone. I think they cost about a nickel, and I thought that was a pretty good deal. My age as a kid, but Owen, he never talked. He never talked. Dad used to say, my land, did they cut your tongue out? And he'd just shake his head. And I don't know, I think it was about a month before he ever said a word. People got concerned for it. They'd cut out his speech, but when his throat healed up, well, then he began to talk. But anyway, back to this. As I got ready to, in February of 1947, I went in to be operated on, and I had talked to Julie about this a time or two, but I didn't want her there while I was coming out of the ether. I was afraid I'd do the same thing I did when I was a kid and come out of the ether. Now, when they operated on me to take my gallbladder out, they'd improve the technique some. Dr. Cragen used to tell me back when he discovered I had gallstones, he said, good land, you. I can't operate on you, a boy 13 years old. I can't take you in there and take your gallbladder out for two or three reasons. One of them was that they'd laugh me right out of the medical profession. Another one is you die. He said all these operations are a success, but the way they do that one now, the patients all die. So in 1946, when I went in to get physical to get married, he said, we now have the technique. Let's get your affairs lined up and get squared around. And this winter, when you're not doing much, you take out your gallbladder. And we can do that now without any problem. He said, we give you a spinal, and you won't even have to take ether. And so when I got ready to do that, they gave me the spinal, but they gave me too low. They made the incision all right, but then when they reached up in to get all that gallbladder, that was live meat. And I said, hey, you butchers. Ah, he says, you can't feel that. And I said, feel that, you crazy fool. That's live meat. Gosh, he said, what are we going to have to do? We'd have to put you out. He said, it'll make you sick. We give you ether. I said, what in the world do you think this is going to do? I ain't going to put up with you two butchers acting that way. So they had to put me out with ether. And as they put me out, I was far enough out that I couldn't answer him. But I still knew when they cut that gallbladder out, but I couldn't, it didn't hurt, really. I was near enough out, but I could still hear them. And they were starting to sew me back up before I was clear out. But when I came out, first thing I asked your mother, what did I do when I was coming out of ether? And she said, you didn't. You did just fine. Now, I don't know whether I did or whether I didn't. Some years after that, why, your mother and I and Bob Hammond and his wife were down at the temple. Sitting in that first room, a man that we knew, I'm not going to put his name on tape, took an epileptic fit right there at the side of us. We just picked him up and took him outside and laid him on the floor. They went on with the session, and we picked him up and took him over to the hospital. Over there, the doctor gave him a shot of pentothal and put him out. When he came to, he was all right. But in the middle of that transaction, he called us every dirty, low-down son of a gun there was. And I imagine it was a little bit like when I was a kid. But anyway, when he come to, first thing he said to me, Brother Alms, did I make a fool of myself? And I said, you did just fine. You did just fine. And for years after that, every time he'd see me, he said, I always wondered if you told me the truth. And I said, well, you've no sense you wonder. Now I'm not going to tell you any different. So don't you worry about it. And on the way back from the hospital, when he was all right and his family had come to get him, there was a fellow from Brigham City that had helped us. And he said, you know, he said, we operated on my father years ago. He said his dad was a mild-mannered man, never raised his voice or thing. He said, operated on him for a double hernia. And he said, Dad had filled a mission in France when he was a boy. And he said, no, I'd filled a mission in my time. And he said, as we were bringing Dad out of ether, my brother and I just coaxed Mother to leave. And said, she wouldn't go. Finally, he said, Dad was got about to that point coming to. And he cut loose on us, and he called us every dirty, low-down son of a gun there was. In two languages. Thank goodness she didn't understand French, but I did. Said, my brother and I were bigger than Dad, but we were just doing all we could do to hold him on that bed. And we just kept saying, Mother, will you please leave? Mother, will you please leave? And finally, in tears, my mother left. Said, almost broke her heart. Said, we swore her to secrecy. Don't you tell Dad what he said. Because Dad has never spoke to you in anything but a kind manner, and don't you ever tell him what he said. So the first thing Dad said when he come to was, what did I say? Did I make a fool of myself? And he said, my brother and I assured him that he did just fine. Now, sometimes in this anesthetic business, and you're not in control, see, things get a little bit wild. And I thought I'd enter this here. But that was quite a thing. But to get that gallbladder out, and I got by quite well for 20 years. And from then on, I've had to take Bilron capsules. It's a bile salt, occasionally. 20 years later, I guess just about the time Glenn was getting ready to go on a mission, I had to go back into hospital, and the adhesions had taken in and shut that gall duct off. And that was pretty tough. That was real mean. And they had to enlarge that gall duct and take out the adhesions of the old operation. But along the line, a few years before that, Julia had her gallbladder out, and I always said we got along so good because there's no gall between us. So I've had a little history of the
been under the surgeon's knife a couple of times, three times, I guess, if you count the taking out my tonsils. One time along here, I'll tell you about my car wreck. That was the toughest course I ever had, I believe. Well, let's see how this sounds. When I used to have those gallstone attacks, Reed and Howard were both used to it. I'd be out in the field working, with hauling hay or whatever, and I'd just quit and go somewhere where there's some shade and roll up, curl up in a knot, just as near a knot as I could, and go to sleep, see if I could go to sleep part of that off, because that, I know one day Reed said I was asleep underneath, the wagon was parked over there, and I crawled under the wagon and went to sleep. Somebody come along, and I was just as wise as a sheet, and of course he was used to that. But that was real painful, and I was asleep. And if I could sleep off part of those attacks, it helped it. It made life more pleasant. So somebody come along and said, you better get him to a doctor. And said, better leave him alone. Doctors can't help him. He'll be all right in a little while, but don't you wake him up. You leave him alone. And that's the way it went for years. When I was about 13 years old, so when I was 27, February 27, when I had my gallbladder out. My golly, that was, I wish they could have done that when I was a kid. But they didn't seem to be able to.